This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Yeah, historically, during the fight with Boko Haram here in Niger, you have to understand that Poso was the first city to be attacked in February 2015. You know, a few days before, they attacked Malam Fattori, Nigeria, like a few kilometers from the border. And Poso was the first major city to be attacked in the morning by Boko Haram fighters.
That's Nicolas Pinot reporting from Poso, Niger. We'll have the full story coming up.
Also, a suicide attack in Cameroon's far north province has left 3 people dead and 4 wounded. A report by Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission says nearly 670 people were killed in unrest from late 2015 to August of last year, and investigators find 17 mass graves in the DRC's Kasai Central province.
We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, a suicide attack in Cameroon's far north province has left 3 people dead and 4 wounded. A source close to the country's security services told AFP that the bomber crossed the border from Nigeria and blew himself up in the town of Kolofata. Among the dead were a police officer and 2 civilians. The surrounding region is often targeted by Boko Haram extremists. 2 years ago, more than 20 people were killed by bombings in the nearby town of Karawa, about 10 kilometers away.
Nigeria's northern neighbor, Niger, continues to feel the effects of the Boko Haram insurgency, facing challenges such as restoring education and food insecurity. Niger is making a slow but steady recovery. Reporter Nicolas Pinol revisited Boso, a city that has historical significance in the region. It was the first city attacked in Niger by Boko Haram in 2015. He spoke with me about Boso and how citizens are trying to resume their lives after Boko Haram.
Yeah, historically, during the fight with Boko Haram here in Niger, you have to understand that Boso was the first city to be attacked in February 2015. You know, a few days before, they attacked Malam Fattori, Nigeria, like a few kilometers from the border. And Boso was the first major city to be attacked in the morning by Boko Haram fighters. You know, it's really important, that city, because it shows you the evolution of the fight against Boko Haram in Niger. So first attack was in February 2015, and then they attacked again in June 2016. And what's important is that back in 2016, the Niger army had to retreat because they could not, you know, support the fight. And the Boko Haram members, they occupied the city for 24 hours. Now we are in April 2017, and we have to say that the situation has changed because basically, you know, life, you know, slowly is getting back to normal. School has reopened back in October 2016. I was able to visit the school. You have temporary shelters and you have some buildings. You have about 1,000 students. Range from 5 years old to 11 years old in the class. Obviously, it's very hot in the tents and in the shelters. But, you know, they're trying to build something new and something normal in Boso. You have a huge contingent of Chadian army. The Niger army is around the city, but the city of Boso itself is secured by the army of Chad. So you have hundreds of Chadian soldiers patrolling the city, especially around the school, to make sure that the Boko Haram fighters, they don't try to attack the city.
Another big challenge that is going on right now in that area is also food security. Can you tell us about what the food situation is like now?
Mainly in the Difa region where Boso is, it is challenging. According to UNICEF, 12,000 kids under 5 will suffer malnutrition this year. And overall, Niger is in Sahel, the region. You know, each year is very difficult because of high temperatures and the drought. According to the World Food Program in Niger itself, 1.5 million people live in food insecurity. So we have to be clear, there's no famine here like you have in South Sudan, but still you have some tough cases. I was able to visit a center for mothers and children here in Difa, and you know, you have kids very, very, very in danger. I can remember kids being 2 years old and he was barely weighing 12 pounds, which is like very, very difficult to see, like, for any parents. So the situation is not like what you have across the border with Nigeria, but still, you have some concern here.
Looking ahead, what do you see in the future, in the next few months for that particular town?
So right now we are at the beginning of this challenge, and many, many doctors and experts in the region, they say the next coming months, you know, right before the rainy season, you're going to have more and more cases. This is usually the peak for malnutrition here in Niger. So they're prepared to face that challenge.
That was reporter Nicholas Pinot. He spoke with me from the Niger-Nigerian border.
Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission has presented a report to Parliament that says nearly 670 people were killed in unrest from late 2015 to August of last year. The government imposed a state of emergency last October following violent protests in the Oromia, Amhara and SNNP regions. Reuters reports that the commission acknowledged that security forces had taken what it calls disproportionate measures in quelling the protests. Last October, the Ethiopian government blamed elements in Eritrea, Egypt and other countries for fueling the demonstrations.
UN investigators have found 17 mass graves in Kasai Central Province in the Central Republic of the Congo. Officials say the new discoveries bring to a total 40 sites discovered in the area since August. Civilians said the armed forces of the DRC dug the graves in late March after clashing with the Kamanuna Nasapu militia. It is loyal to a customary chief and recruits children to attack schools, police stations, and other government symbols. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights criticized the government for not undertaking an independent investigation into alleged killings and human rights abuses. Zayed Rahad Al-Hussein said the International Criminal Court could do so if necessary.
Ugandan traders in Kampala have taken to the streets to protest the influx of Chinese nationals doing petty trade in the central business district. The traders argue that retail and wholesale business should be left for Ugandan nationals. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Work came to a standstill in Kampala's central business district as traders marched through the streets. They carried placards indicating they want Chinese traders out of retail and wholesale shops in the central business districts, also known as the CBD. Most of the arcades and shops in the CBD remained closed as traders threatened to destroy the merchandise of Chinese businessmen. The traders are also protesting the government's failure to revoke licenses of the Chinese traders, despite an earlier pronouncement by President Yoweri Museveni that foreign investors must leave retail and wholesale businesses for Ugandans and move to industrial parks. Mohammed Nsereko, the Member of Parliament representing Kampala Central, joined the traders' protest, saying Chinese investors should consider investing in bigger projects or voluntarily return to their country.
The Chinese come in road construction. When their work permits expire, they do not leave. There is no single country that does not protect her borders. It's only Uganda, where everyone just walks in and walks out, does petty business to that extent that there are, some are barbers, some are chapati vendors, others are selling fish. The Chinese must go back to their country and do the businesses that they are supposed to do. They are not here as retailers. Others are mechanics here, down here in Chiseka Market. They are competing with these young men. We need to protect our citizens. They should come doing big investments.
Under their umbrella, the Kampala City Traders Association, the traders accused the Chinese of pushing them out of business by selling substandard and low-priced goods. Association chairperson Everest Kayondo questioned why government is so lenient with the Chinese while China treats Ugandans who go there in a different manner.
When we go to China, as we are filling their forms, they will say we are giving you this visa and you are entering on condition that you will not do any job in China, even if it is for free. And the reciprocity would demand that you treat other people's citizens as they treat yours.
A Uganda government committee had given the Ministry of Trade an ultimatum to have all Chinese out of petty trade by last December. 4 months into 2017, no government action has been taken, and the Chinese nationals continue opening more shops in the central business district. However, Uganda's Trade Minister Amelia Chambade assures that no new Chinese or foreign traders' petty business will be licensed this year.
No new license will be issued for 2017 unless the applicants comply with our laws. The Directorate of Immigration is considering suspending issuers of Class D and Class G work permits to foreigners intending to do business in the Central Business District of Kampala.
Although there are no official records, it is estimated that there are between 10,000 and 50,000 Chinese nationals doing petty business in Uganda. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi declared a nationwide state of emergency after the Palm Sunday terrorist attacks on two Coptic Christian churches. The emergency laws are in response to the expansion of terrorism from the Sinai Peninsula to major cities in Egypt. VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi asked Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, former director of the U.S. State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications, about President Sisi's latest measure.
Emergency laws or such laws are a temporary solution. They're an interim step while the government has to do other things. There's nothing wrong with emergency laws in the short term, but they're a band-aid. They're only a temporary measure that has to be part of a larger strategy to fight terrorism.
So how do you explain the rise of terrorist attacks in Egypt when President al-Sisi was given a mandate to fight terrorism 4 years ago?
The reason is, of course, there is an organization that 4 years ago rose that slowly and aggressively has exploded in the region, and that's the Islamic State. And the Islamic State had success in communicating its message, in harnessing Salafi jihadist activism and violence in the region. And Egypt is the largest Arab country, has always been targeted by the jihadists. It's always a country that they've seen as they would like to mobilize, they would like to take advantage of it. They have, there's been terrorist attacks in Egypt for many years, but Egypt has never been subverted or become prey to the terrorist targets as much as the terrorists would like. But it's a fat target, a big target, so it's something they're going to continue to try to attack.
But some experts argue that what contributed to the rise in terrorism is resorting to repression, torture, and human rights violations, which created, in their opinion, a culture of revenge and alienated thousands of Egyptians. Do you agree with such analysis?
I think that analysis is not completely correct. It's only partially correct. Of course, injustice and repression is not a good thing. But the motivators for terrorism and for extremism are much more complicated. You see, for example, a country like Tunisia, which is a democracy, and it's a major exporter of jihadists to the Islamic State and has its own terrorist movement inside Tunisia. This is a liberal, democratic state where human rights are respected. So the situation is more complicated than merely, oh, the Egyptian government is bad and therefore there's a reaction to it. It's much more complicated than that. There are many factors that lead into people becoming terrorists. There are many factors in Egypt which lead to radicalization. Poverty or repression are only part, not the whole answer. There is also a conscious effort to create a Salafi and Salafi jihadist subculture in Egypt through funding, through activism, through media, through propaganda, that has created a subworld or subculture that feeds into the terrorism of what we see today in Egypt. So blaming the current Egyptian government is a simplistic answer to a much more complicated question.
But so far, the Egyptian government relied solely on the security solution. What do you recommend as a comprehensive strategy to counter terrorism in Sinai and beyond?
The security solution, the use of the coercive powers of the state, is absolutely essential. But it has to be done efficiently and correctly. The work of the military and of the police and the security services is essential. But in addition to that, the challenge is much larger, and these other issues need to be addressed. Basically, what are the factors in society, especially in terms of education, propaganda, in terms of media, that lead towards radicalization? So you need to have an aggressive way to respond to the ideological challenge of Salafi jihadism, not just on the battlefield or not just with law enforcement, but also in the arts, in media, in the school system, in the mosque. All of that needs to happen. And both the security part and the intellectual part, or the ideological and educational part, has to be done much more efficiently, much more powerfully than it's been done before.
Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, the former director of the U.S. State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications, speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shanawi. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick, and at 21 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Ethiopia's Human Rights Commission presents a report to Parliament that says nearly 670 people were killed during months of unrest in the country. Investigators find 17 mass graves in the DRC's Kasai Central province, bringing to 40 the number of gravesites found in the area since August. And the people of Boso Niger are picking up the pieces after the Boko Haram insurgency. For more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Well, the infamous man-eating lions of Tsavo, portrayed in the 1996 film The Ghost and the Darkness, apparently had a practical reason to attack humans. A study of the lion's teeth tells the dietary tale. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
In the late 1890s, construction was underway on the Kenya-Uganda Railway. To complete the route, a bridge had to be built over Kenya's Tsavo River. Between March and December, two male lions began attacking workers, even dragging them from their tents at night. Despite repeated efforts to protect the Indian workers and kill the lions, the attacks continued. Many workers quit their jobs and left. The lions had no manes, possibly because of the hot, dry conditions in Tsavo. They were eventually shot dead by Railway Project Chief Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson. But it took several tries and a lot of bullets. One of the lions reportedly even stalked Patterson at night after it was wounded. The exact number of victims is not known. Some estimates say about 10 to 20 people, but one says 135. The lions were later stuffed and put on display at Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History. Larissa DeSantis and a colleague wanted to find out why humans became a large part of their diet.
I'm mainly a paleontologist, and I study fossil animals. And one of the ways in which I study fossil animals is I study sort of the modern animals, including things like cheetahs, lions, and hyenas, where we can observe what they're actually doing, what they're eating, and we can correlate that with different tools. And in particular, we can correlate that with their dental microwear, so the microscopic wear patterns left on their teeth.
DeSantis is assistant professor of Earth and Environmental Studies at Vanderbilt University.
So, for example, hyenas, which are actively consuming bone, have really sort of pitted and gouged surfaces on their teeth compared to cheetahs, which are primarily eating flesh and softer parts of the carcass.
In this case, they did not study animal fossils, but rather the stuffed lions in the museum.
We were really trying to get at the motivations of these man-eating lions, and if they were desperately consuming carcasses, and that's why they switched to man-eating.
So, were the lions desperate for human flesh because their natural prey succumbed to drought or disease like rinderpest? That was a leading theory. But DeSantis and her colleague, Bruce Patterson, curator of mammals at the Field Museum, found another reason after looking at the microwear on their teeth.
We were pretty surprised because we thought we were going to find hyena-like dental microware, and we didn't see that at all. In fact, we saw that their microware was most similar to captive lions, which are typically provisioned with softer foods, including things like ground meat. So it wasn't that they were sort of crunching and munching on everything that they could sink their teeth into. It looks like man-eating might have been a pretty easy solution to their need for food.
The lions realized that killing a human was easier than chasing and taking down a zebra. But were they just lazy? Were humans the big cat's version of fast food? There's more to it than that. DeSantis and Patterson, no relation to the British officer, found the same microware when they looked at another man-eating lion. This one from Mfuwe, Zambia, that ate at least six people in 1991. DeSantis says all three lions apparently had dental and gum disease or some type of jaw injury. Grabbing and holding down prey with their jaws hurt a lot. They were hungry and could kill people with much less effort. Whether humans were as tasty as a zebra or buffalo is not known, but the Tsavo lion that had fewer dental problems also ate fewer people.
Well, I think it changes the way we look at ourselves. We like to think of ourselves on the top of the food chain. In reality, we have been on the menu of large cats for a long time. So even early ancestors were consumed by large cats, and there's anthropological evidence of this. And even today, humans are consumed by lions.
Professor DeSantis says, for example, in Tanzania, between January of 1990 and September of 2004, 563 humans were killed by lions. And last year, there was a case in India where lions hunted humans in the Gur National Forest. Three lions were found guilty and sentenced to life in an animal sanctuary. It's not clear whether dental or jaw problems played a role in these cases. Nevertheless, don't be tempted by YouTube videos where some people hug a lion. You could very easily be the main course. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
And that's a wrap from this edition of Africa News Tonight. Stay tuned for Straight Talk Africa with Shaka Sali coming up at 18:30 UTC. I'm Heidi Adams-Fitzpatrick in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Africa, this is James Butte, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Hello, I am Shaka Sali. Join me on Straight Talk Africa every Wednesday as we discuss topics of special interest to Africans, including politics, economic development, press freedom, health, social issues, and conflict resolution. Take your pick. Watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio.
Looking for something? Headline news, interviews,
analysis. We've got it all on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.